Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting the show today. I spend the first hour talking with you about bacteria. They're all around us. Some of them are pretty important, and they can do some pretty neat things. They can affect weight loss. They can improve your motivation to exercise. They can affect your sleep cycles. They kind of lead a wild life. I think. And they're busy little devils as well, and really interesting. And a guy that knows a whole lot about them is Timothy Poston. Tim is with us in the studio today. He's a distinguished professor in the Department of Bacteriology at UW-Madison. He and his colleagues are doing some really cool research, and we'll get into the work that he's doing as we move along today. And I hope you'll join in. How much do you know about your own microbiome, for example? Or maybe you're wondering about how life began on Earth. We can certainly, we will take that up a bit with Tim. And I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Tim Poston, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on the show.
Let's start with the basics. What are bacteria?
So, okay, bacteria are living life forms. They're single cells, unopposed to humans, which are trillions of cells.
Yeah.
So they're a single cell. They also don't have a nucleus, like our cells have a nucleus.
Yeah.
They also grow very quickly. So they're small little critters. They grow very quickly. And as a group, they're incredibly versatile. They can degrade all sorts of things. They can eat the same kind of things we do, proteins, fats, carbohydrates. But then there's organisms that can degrade gasoline. There's organisms that can grow on hydrogen gas. There's organisms that can grow like plants and use light and all sorts of things. So it's an amazing group of organisms.
And we can't really see them with the naked eye, but looking at them under the microscope, they're pretty cool looking, and a variety of shapes and colors. Mm-hmm.
Actually, you can see some. There's organism called Thiomargarita namibii that's off the coast of Namibia that's 1 millimeter in diameter. So you can see some of these guys. Most of them you can't.
But you got to go a long way if you're from Wisconsin if you're going to see one.
Yeah, definitely.
And they're colorful. Purples and reds. Kind of red?
Yeah, sure. If you go and you look into Lake Mendota, of course, you'll see a lot of algae. But you will also see a lot of green cyanobacteria, especially in the summer when it gets a little too warm and there's a little bit too much stuff in the water because of runoff.
Yeah. Yeah,
the cyanobacteria will grow, and you can see them too. And there's purple bacteria, absolutely.
So why should you be spending all your time? Why do a lot of people spend their time studying, and why should we, as people, be wondering why and why?
Okay, so why study bacteria? Why is it important? Of course, the first thing that everybody thinks of is disease. And microorganisms cause some pretty important diseases. If you also include viruses, which are microbes, COVID-19 was a virus. But also E. coli is normally a good friend of ours and lives in our colon. But if it picks up the wrong set of genes, it can cause terrible diarrhea. Hemorrhagic E. coli will cause outbreaks sometimes. Salmonella causes disease. Tuberculosis is also caused by a bacterium. So that's one reason, is a medical reason. But the other thing is they're really important for your health. You have a whole group of organisms that live inside you, right? And technically it's not inside you. It's in your digestive tract, okay? But they live there and they help you digest nutrients. They help feed your cells in your colons and stuff and keep them healthy. So they're really useful that way. And then the third thing I'll say, and then I'll stop, is that they're really important in the environment. They're important for recycling all sorts of elements. Trees in the forest get degraded by fungi. Bacteria will help degrade all sorts of compounds in the environment and recycle all sorts of elements.
Yeah, and there's some research on probably on some of that we can get to in a bit. And so, I mean, there's, you know, maybe a few hundred bad guys.
Mm-hmm. That's about right, yeah.
But all the rest, and I mean, there's, I mean, I don't know how many.
There's about 18,000 known characterized species. But there's probably many more than that, because we've figured out techniques in the last few decades where we can actually go out in the environment and detect them without having to culture them. And so it uses DNA sequencing and, you know, grabbing DNA and just sequencing it and see what's there. There's probably hundreds of thousands or millions of different species.
That's amazing. Claire was telling me, Claire Neipert, our producer, was telling me that the Museum of Natural History at Oxford says there are more species of bacteria than any other life form.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. But then, okay, this gets into another thing, is how do you define a species for a bacteria? That's not an easy question, because the way we define it for large organisms or macroorganisms is, can they reproduce and make offspring that can also reproduce, right?
Yeah.
Well, bacteria can't do that, so they only grow by dividing. But then they have this really intriguing property, is they will share DNA with one another, and they don't even have to be closely related. So you can have an organism that lives in the lake giving DNA to an organism that happens to be in the lake but is normally found in your colon. And so that's called horizontal gene transfer. So it really makes it hard to define a species, because they're always swapping around their DNA over a long periods of time. Infrequent event, but it definitely happens.
You mentioned viruses there, and there's a difference between virus and, aren't viruses, they're not living, are they?
Well, okay, that's another debate in science. There's some people that say, no, they're living. I'm in the camp that says, no, they're not, because they can't really reproduce on their own. So yes, viruses, I would say it's fair to say they're not living organisms, right? But they are things that can replicate. And so that they can cause all sorts of problems for people and different organisms, but they also have very important uses. Because there's viruses that actually attack bacteria, and they keep the populations of bacteria under control.
I guess I didn't realize, or had forgotten it.
Yeah, no, I was really surprised when I was a student and I took my first microbiology class, and they start talking about viruses that infect bacteria, and I'm like, what? That really was really surprising to me.
Yeah, and you were talking about how the bacteria are in our gut, but they're also on our skin,
yes.
As you obviously well know. And you and I were talking before class, in my intro bacteriology class in the lab, the first thing practically they gave us was a plate of agar, and we had to stick a finger on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next lab period, there were all kinds of bacteria on that agar that yep. came right from my finger.
Yeah, and that when we still do that experiment today. Now, we've made some modifications to it where we'll have students like put their finger on the agar, and then we say, okay, try and use some disinfectant on your finger or whatever you want. We give them a bunch of options. Yeah. You can wash your hands or whatever. Do it again, and sometimes they'll see even more bacteria because now they've loosened them up and they fall off. All right. But the thing to remember is most of those guys are your friends. One that's almost on every person is called Staphylococcus epidermidis, and it competes off other bacteria that would be harmful and protects you from them. So it's good that it's there.
And Staphylococcus, I was trying to remember, aureus. Staphylococcus,
yes, yeah, very good.
Staphylococcus aureus can live, I've read somewhere, it can live on clothing.
Yes.
For weeks.
Yes. And Staph aureus is a significant pathogen, especially strains that are resistant to methicillin. They're called methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. And that can be that's a significant problem. So that will live in about 50% of humans, from the research that I've read, will have that in their nose. So I got two interesting stories about that. Number one, they were having problems with knee replacements and them getting infected with Staph aureus. And so they went through all of the the surgeons and tested them out and made sure they were using aseptic technique. They looked at the operating theaters, the nurses, everybody who took care of the patient. And all of that was fine, and they couldn't figure it out until they realized they were getting infected once they went home. And it's when this patients had to change their dressings, they were picking their nose.
Oh.
And when they educated people about not doing that and being really careful when you change your dressing, it dropped the infections 85%.
Whoa! Yeah.
So that was just the funny things that you'll find like that.
And I imagine even if you just kind of swipe your nose like I just did now, mm-hmm. could do it.
Yeah, definitely.
You don't have to be...
Yeah, just like your mom told you, don't pick your nose.
Oh, man. Tim Boschet, our guest today, as we talk with him about the world of bacteria, and we haven't even gotten into the research that they're doing. This is some really cool stuff. Questions or comments for him, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Professor Tim Boschet today, a distinguished professor in the Department of Bacteriology at UW-Madison, and we're zeroing in on bacteria and the research that his group is doing. They're doing a lot, actually, and it'll be fun to learn some more about them as we move along. Tim, you mentioned hand sanitizer just in passing. We already got an email. What are some ways to kill bacteria? For example, does the hand sanitizer really kill bacteria?
Okay, so my first question would be to you is, why do you want to kill them, right? Sometimes there's good reason. You don't want bacteria in your food. If you know, like, you have a cut and you want to, you know, fix that, yeah, that's a good reason. But so let me answer that question, and then I'll branch off as a tangent.
All right, go ahead.
All right, so yeah. So hand sanitizers do decrease the number of microorganisms that are there. So they will definitely decrease what we call the microbial load. So they're fine. But, you know, don't overuse them. There's no reason to do that. One of the best things you can do if you want to clean your hands is, very straightforward, wash your hands. Yeah. And do it well, right? The CDC will recommend that you wash your hands with soap and you sing through a verse of Happy Birthday.
Yeah.
And then that will clean off your hands. So that's a good way to do it. As far as like cleaning your laundry or sanitizing your laundry, you could use bleach. But again, I don't think that's necessary. I think in some ways, and now I'm off into the tangent, there's other ways. Heat does a really good job. Mm-hmm. So heating things to, let's see, I gotta do math. 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 115 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about 60 degrees centigrade, will kill almost all the bacteria that you'd need to worry about. So heating things is another good way to do that. That's why they always give you boil water advisories.
Yeah.
That's really effective. So the tangent is that bacteria are your friends, again.
Yeah.
I want to keep emphasizing that, and you really don't want to get rid of them. A lot of the time, and there's actually some research that the reason we're seeing more allergies in the human population is because our environment is too clean, and we're not getting exposed to the environment enough to develop, just for your immune system to learn, oh, that's okay, I don't need to worry about that bacteria or that thing that I'm allergic to. And so our environment might be too clean in some cases.
Yeah, really interesting. Karen in Wausau has something for us. Let's go there. Hi,
okay.
Karen.
Hi, Karen.
Oh, I just wanted to say I was coming home from the library and I heard Tim Boschet and I thought, oh my gosh, that's my nephew.
Hi,
on
Karen.
The radio. What in the world? And I just was. He's a wonderful, wonderful boy.
Oh, boy.
Anyway.
Okay, for the record, I did not tell Karen about this, and I did not pay her to call in.
No, he didn't. He didn't. I'm just so thrilled. I quick called my daughter to turn on the radio. Anyway, I don't wash my hands as often as I should. I know that. But I haven't been sick or had anything, COVID, whatever, for years. So I was wondering if sometimes it can be too much.
Well, that's kind of what we were just talking about.
Yeah,
I think in a way, and Karen probably wasn't hearing all that because she was just getting put on the phone.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it can be too much. Okay. But again, most people probably don't wash their hands enough. So I'm not going to say don't wash your hands, because you should. Anytime you have a meal, you should wash your hands. Anytime you're preparing food, you're going to wash your hands. Anytime you're putting your hands near your mouth, you should wash your hands. All right. And so that can actually greatly decrease transmission. But Karen, I'll tell you one other thing that's really interesting that we've learned about COVID after the pandemic and ongoing, is there's a class of people that have a difference in their cells. All right. And it's called, okay, a big word here, a major histocompatibility complex 2. Okay. And they will have this complex and major histocompatibility complex 1. Right. There's some people that have a change in that. So there's variation within the human population, of course. And they'll have a change in that so that if they've ever had a coronavirus and they do cause colds too, it would cross react with COVID, and those people are much less likely to get COVID. So you might be in that group, and that's why you've never had it.
That is very, very cool. Karen, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Yeah, thanks.
Judy and Baronette, we'll go to you. Hi, Judy.
Hello. I think people are fanatics about being clean now, and I keep a clean house, trust me on this, but from what I understand, kids that were raised on the farm, I'm 83, mm-hmm. kids that were raised on the farm back in that day are healthier because we were exposed to everything back then. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, one of my absolute main pet peeves is that people buy water in plastic bottles when we have beautiful wells all over the place.
You know what? We're going to be talking about plastic bottles coming up in the next hour, Judy, recycling and maybe getting rid of plastic bottles.
Yeah, Judy, I wholeheartedly agree with you. I think it's silly to buy water in plastic bottles. The water that you get from your municipality and almost always from your wells is just fine. Of course, get it tested. The municipalities, you don't, because, of course, they test. But if you have a well, get it tested. But more than likely, it's fine. You're just throwing away money buying water. So I totally agree with you. For your previous point, yes, there is actually research that shows that people who grow up in rural environments and are exposed to more what are called antigens, just stuff in the environment, seem to be healthier. You know, that's you got to be careful with that, because I don't want to say, you know, you can't be absolutist about it. But it does seem that they have fewer allergies. They seem to be a little bit better in their immune system. But there may be something to that.
I grew up on a farm, and back in the day when, you know, mom would say, go outside and don't come back. It's time to eat. Yeah. And, you know, we did everything. And I had a pretty, well, I had measles and a few of those things. Yeah. But I had a pretty, I'm not allergic to anything.
Yeah.
That's, yep. Which is.
Yeah, well, a lot of people aren't.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not. For sure. Judy, it's a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for calling. Let's go to Paul in Toma. Hi, Paul.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm interested in trying to prevent some wood rot. And I've been reading about two chemicals, one called copper naphthenate and another one called borat, which is supposedly goes after the digestive system of bacteria that causes rot. Now, it's supposed to last 50 to 60 years, and every article I've read just says this is the stuff to use. It's water-based, so they say you have to seal it in from drying out or prevent it from getting rained on. Are you familiar with these chemicals, this process of going after the digestive system of bacteria to prevent the rot? Is it too good to be true? Because I'm going to be using some 6x6, 6x8 birch and poplar, which are notorious of woods that do rot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got to tell you, I'm not an expert in that field. I don't know anything about those compounds, so I got to honestly say that. But as far as they're saying, the digestive system, bacteria really don't have a digestive system. So you said the one is copper-based and the other one's called borat?
Borate.
Borate. Okay, yeah. Yeah, borate. I can answer that then. Yeah, those will work. What they do is fungi are what actually cause rot of wood for the most part. And if you put those kind of things in the wood, they are poisonous to their metabolisms, and they will prevent them. So, yeah, it seems legitimate to me. But, yeah, I just want to warn you, I'm not an expert in this. I haven't looked at it that much. But those things should probably work.
And as a matter of fact, we've talked about this on the show in the past with builders and so forth, and borate is something that's commonly used to for that sort of circumstance.
Yes.
For sure. Paul, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or shoot an email to talk@wpr.org. Tim, we were right at the beginning. We were talking a little bit about the origins of life, mm-hmm. and you actually looked into that. I mean, how life began. You know, bacteria were kind of the first, maybe.
Yeah, sure. It seems like bacteria were the first forms of life, and I don't do research on this, but Betul Kassar in our department does. And she's an amazing scientist and doing all sorts of creative experiments. So I'll tell you one of the most interesting experiments that has come out in the last few years. So because we've developed all this sequencing technology, and a lot of it was developed to figure out the human genome, right? So we took that technology, and we are interested in sequencing bacteria. And it kept getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. You can now sequence an entire genome of a microorganism, a bacterium, which is about 4.5 million base pairs. You can sequence that for $10 now. You know, it's just amazing how cheap it's gotten. We've done research. I did research with Carrie Kuhn, and I had my class do a research project with her where we sequenced all the organisms that we isolated 178 different organisms from mosquitoes. We sequenced all their genomes. It cost us $10,000. It's just like crazy how cheap it is. So what did they do with all this sequence? We have thousands and thousands and thousands of organisms sequenced now. And they went, well, if you think about it, the first living thing, if you took all those organisms, all those sequences, and looked at what they have in common and traced it back, and you looked at, I don't want to go into any more specifics than that because then everybody will be going, what are you talking about? But if you looked at all those sequences and you trace it back and say what they have in common, we have a reasonable guess what the first microorganism was. And it was an organism that grew on hydrogen gas. And there was lots of hydrogen gas, and it used carbon dioxide as its source of carbon. So Betul Kassar, what she's doing is she's taking one of these genes that goes way back, mm-hmm. and it's called nitrogenase. And you can look at all the sequences, and by comparing them all, you can make a pretty good guess of what the original or an earlier nitrogenase was. And so what they're trying to do now is take that gene, put it in a modern bacterium, make the nitrogenase that we think is really ancient, and see if it works. You know, that's really cool.
And, you know, you think the building blocks of life, what we always call, remember from one class, N-chops or something like that. N-chops, nitrogen, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen,
phosphorus and sulfur.
Sulfur, yeah.
Yes.
And that makes up almost all of an organism.
It makes up 97% of all organisms. So the elements that are in all organisms on Earth are those. So why is it just those? Well, that goes back to, get this, star formation, right? So when stars were made, and when a star, you know, it's growing, and then it gets old, and it stops growing. When it's glowing, right? It will make those elements and quite a few others, but so those are some of the most common elements. So it makes sense. We are made of the most common some of the most common elements on Earth.
Yeah.
So it makes sense. So there's only six, but even that, if you look at what our macromolecules are made of, our proteins, our nucleic acids, our DNA, our membranes, you can break it down into four things. We're made of sugars, amino acids, fatty acids, And let's see, and now the last one's escaping me. Lipids. That's it. Those four. That's it. So life, while it's incredibly complex, and we spent hundreds of years studying it and understanding it, its basic building blocks are four Legos. You know, and that's really kind of amazing.
Amos in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Amos.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for letting me through. Just wanted to call and ask about probiotics. Just kind of interested, what are some of the best ones on the market? And then I was always kind of curious, when you are orally taking a probiotic, does your gut acid, does your stomach acid neutralize any of those? And is it really beneficial? Or how beneficial is it? And what are some of the best probiotics to take?
Okay, Amos, that's a great question. And there's a lot of information. If you would have asked me this question 15 years ago, I would have told you to be really skeptical about probiotics because they might work, but they might not. But then there were some seminal papers that came out, and they looked at giving mice different strains of lactobacillus, and it would protect them against listeria. And so that was one of the first, and they actually traced down to what was going on is the lactobacillus was producing a compound that's called a bacitracin. It's a peptide, but it's kind of like an antibiotic, but it's not an antibiotic. And that bacitracin was killing the pathogen. It was killing the listeria. And so it's like, okay, so this is real. And then there's been a lot of research about this. And we found some organisms. And again, they've done it the same way as what I talked about before, where they'll go in and they'll get someone's poo, right? And they'll go through and they'll sequence all the DNA that's in there, and they'll understand what organisms are there. And then they'll compare people, and they'll look at that and say, well, okay, what's different, what's good here, and compare that to different characteristics. So we've identified some organisms, such as Brevibacterium, and I bet you've heard that name, or Bifidobacterium, or Lactobacillus is another one you often hear, that seem to have benefits to them. Now, to answer your question, are there good probiotics? Maybe. It's kind of too early to tell. They're probably not dangerous, all right? But, I mean, I'd have to know exact specifics. But I can give you some advice. If they're telling you it has positive effects, do they point to studies that show that it has positive effects? And those things are all available because of the wonders of the internet. You can find that information and dig through it. And if you spend enough time, you know, you can figure out what it means. So, there are some that could be useful. Now, one bit of interesting information, a lot of the research that I've read, and again, I always couch things, and I'm not in this field, I'm maybe not up on everything that's going on, has shown that if you take a probiotic, it will survive your stomach, but it doesn't take up residence in your microbiome. You have to keep taking it. It can have a beneficial effect, but you have to keep taking it. It doesn't seem to take up residence. But, you know, I haven't seen real long-term studies. If someone takes a probiotic for a year, does it then take up residence? I don't know.
We had an email from Mark that goes along, relates to this. He's been following diet utilizing L-reiteri. R-E-U-T-E-R-I, and specific strains for normalizing his gut flora.
Okay.
And he just wonders about their health benefits in terms of digestion and so forth.
My question would be to you, does it seem to have an effect for you? It might. I can't really tell you definitively whether it works or not. There's so many different probiotics out there making so many different claims, but what you got to do is you got to look, is it backed up by science? The one caution I'll give you is the placebo effect is real. So you can't really do a controlled study on yourself because you know you're taking it. What I would look for is double-blind studies of the probiotics or the things that you're taking that demonstrate that there is a positive effect, and there are some. But you really got to look, dig into the research and find out, and I encourage you to do that.
And thanks for that email. And Amos, again, thank you for your call. Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too, with a call. The number 1234. You could email the talk at WPR.org. Well, all kinds of questions coming in. Janet in Madison called, couldn't stay with us. She's wondering about the masks we wore for COVID. Mm-hmm. If you keep wearing a COVID mask, are you putting yourself at a disservice?
Okay, so that's an interesting question.
The same one all the time.
Okay, so I'll give you probably this the strongest argument for masks, and it has nothing to do with COVID. It has to do with influenza. They worked for COVID. I don't want to get that, in my opinion. But here it was. If you go back and you look at the CDC data for 2020 and 2021, and you look at the rate of influenza, I think the peak was 50 cases in 2 weeks. Now go look at the data for 2024. It's tens of thousands. Social distancing and masking worked. It decreased the rate of transmission of infectious disease. Now, should you mask all the time because you don't want to get sick? I don't know if that's useful. I mean, if you're not feeling well and you need to go out and you want to prevent other people from getting sick, please wear a mask. That's a great idea. But if you're just generally walking around with a mask on because you don't want to get, you know, whatever some random person has, you know, it depends on your circumstances. If you're taking chemotherapy, absolutely listen to your doctor. They will tell you probably to mask. But for the general population, it's probably not useful. Masks don't do any harm. You know, wearing a mask and maybe taking in a little bit more CO2 than you normally do is not going to be an issue. The difference that it makes is inconsequential in your respiratory system, et cetera. But masks do work.
But I think part of her question was, well, if I wear the same mask all the time, am I going to be collecting stuff that just makes it...
Yeah,
maybe I should be changing masks, because, you know...
Okay, So if you're in a healthcare setting, you will change masks every time you go into a new room, okay, or after a certain amount of time. But that's more because of the chance of something getting on the mask. If these are disposable masks, yeah, you should probably change them. Again, I'm not going to give recommendations.
Yeah.
But do they get grody after a while? Yeah, you can see that. You can smell that. One of the best sensors that you have is your nose. Your nose is more sensitive than many scientific instruments. And if you smell something that's off, that's a good sign that there is an issue. You know, you respond to and are disgusted by certain smells for a reason, and it's evolutionary. That was a bad thing, and we've learned that to avoid that. So, you know, listen to that. So I don't want to give recommendations. I'm not a doctor. I'm not an expert in this field. So I don't want to give recommendations on whether you should change your mask or not. But, yeah, although I will say wear it the right way, it has to cover your nose. It has to be tight to your face. If you wear a mask loosely or on your chin, it's not doing you any good.
Ellen in Eau Claire called. You were talking earlier about lipids and fatty acids. She said she thought that lipids and fatty acids are the same thing.
Okay.
What's the difference?
Okay, fatty acids are a part of the lipid.
Okay.
So a lipid is made of a glycerol molecule that has a phosphate on it, and then you have two fatty acids on it. And then, you know, that's a simplification, of
right.
course. There's all sorts of variations. But yeah, fatty acids are part of the lipids.
Jean emailed us, is well water that has been tested recently by the county but has brown bacteria safe to drink, bathe in, or wash clothes in? It's an old farm well, single family use. Sometimes it looks brownish and smells gross. Her adult kids think it's gross.
Okay, so yeah, I'm not going to answer that question professionally. So you can't hold me to this, okay? But a lot of the time, the brown bacteria are what are called iron bacteria. And, the soil in Wisconsin has a lot of iron in it. And what they do is they actually take the iron and they react it, they oxidize it, and they take an electron away from it. And it turns into a different type of iron molecule called iron plus 3. Iron plus 3 will react with the water and makes iron hydroxide, which is brown. That may be, okay, mm-hmm. I don't know your situation. I'm not there. that may be what's happening. Okay. Also, what does it smell like? Does it smell like rotting food?
Rotten eggs.
Or rotten? It smells like rotten eggs.
Well, that's my guess.
Does it smell like rotten eggs? Or does it just have kind of a rusty smell to it? You know, that can do it. But you should really talk to someone who's an expert in well water, not me. All right. So okay. Yeah, I want to be real careful with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and there are some communities, I'm thinking of some communities in northern Wisconsin where the water comes, that's what you get out of the tap, and yeah. It's the iron.
Yeah, I lived in Whitewater for a while, and we lived on a house that was owned by some very nice farmers. And yeah, our water was brown, it was fine to drink, but yeah. And it smelled kind of, but again, I don't know your situation.
What are the health benefits, a listener wonders in an email, of L-lysine and DHA supplements? Do you know anything about those?
Yeah, I know a little bit about those. So the theory is that those will make your mitochondria younger, is if I'm getting the compounds right. And it's because some research done by Bruce Ames and a number of other people that have shown that as we age, our mitochondria, this is where energy is generated in cells. So it's like the little engines in your thing, or in your cells, in your body. And those engines, as they process stuff, accumulate oxidative damage, or they start to malfunction, and they start to release oxidative damage. It's thought that L-lysine and DHA will, like, alleviate that. But I'm not aware of any. That doesn't mean it's not. There aren't. But I'm not aware of any studies that show that have taken that out of the cellular range and actually done studies in humans to show that it has a positive effect. So I don't know if that works or not.
Whitney emailed us, in the industry of animal agriculture, they've been researching strains of beneficial gut bacteria to reduce the use of antibiotics.
Yes.
She specifically works with for Purina Livestock Division and speaks on this on a daily basis regarding calf health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think there's definitely things you can do with the microbiome. Professor Garrett Soon in her department does a lot of research with dairy cattle. And that might be somebody you might want to get in touch with and see what you're doing and talk to him about maybe doing some work to show whether it's beneficial or not. I would not be shocked if it is beneficial. I think it would be great to get the use of antibiotics out of agriculture. And the reason is this. Yes, the antibiotics that they use for growth promotion in agriculture are not the antibiotics we use to treat disease in humans. But what it is that when you use those antibiotics, you create resistant bacteria to those antibiotics. But what often comes along with that is resistant to medically important antibiotics that we use. Yeah. And so it's a laudable goal to get them out. And I know there's business concerns and, you know, these businesses have to be profitable, et cetera. And I think it's wonderful news for me to hear that people are working on that. I think it'd be a great thing.
And Whitney's probably saying to herself, wait a minute, what was the name of that researcher again?
Garrett Suen, S-U-E-N. He's on the bacteriology department page. And I'm sure Garrett will yell at me for giving out his name on Wisconsin Public Radio. But
Whitney, there you go. Thank you so much for joining in. Tim Poston, our guest today, distinguished professor in the Department of Bacteriology at UW-Madison, talking with him about bacteria. And join in. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. You could email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking bacteria on the show today with our guest, Tim Poston, a distinguished professor in the Department of Bacteriology at UW-Madison, having an interesting and kind of a fun time talking with us about what's going on with our bacteria. And you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. And, you know, when I opened the show, I mentioned that microbes can influence or may influence how you sleep. And Katie emailed and she said, is there any truth to that? Or can you talk about that?
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to talk about that, Katie. All right. So here's the deal. So you have a circadian rhythm, and everybody's heard about circadian rhythms and how that's correlated to, you know, how much light you get, and that's how that's influenced. But that rhythm and how you sleep influences your gut microbiome. So the organisms that you have in your gut will be influenced it. But it also turns out your microbiome might be influencing your sleep. And this can have real-world consequences. For example, shift workers are more likely to develop obesity and diabetes. And they think that might have a relation to their microbiome. All right, so another thing that's, so when you have a lack of sleep, you have significant changes in your gut microbiome. You have more bacteria in your gut than other people that don't have a lack of sleep. There can be invasion past the gut barrier. And so that's not a good thing. You have a barrier, you know, and that's your colon and your small intestine that prevent them to come across. So one of the things that gut microbiota do is they will go in your guts and they take what you eat and they produce a compound called butyrate and acetate, two compounds.
Yeah.
And that will influence this, one of the clocks. You have a number of different clocks. The major one is in your head, but that will influence the clock in your liver. And that will influence, gut bacteria can also influence melatonin production. And that will, that's a sleep hormone.
Yeah.
So an interesting study was done. And this study, This study was done by Nishida. And they found that if they took medical students and they did a double-blind experiment and they gave them Lactobacillus gasseri, they seemed to help with their sleep because medical students, because they're in medical school and all the stress, they have more issues. So definitely it seems that's just one bit of evidence that definitely your gut microbiome can influence your sleep. But definitely it's well known that disrupting your sleep will change your gut microbiome, and then that can have health effects.
Your microbiome can also impact your mental health, mm-hmm. as I understand it. Yes. There was some interesting research that we were looking at involving microbiomes in mice even.
Yes, yes. And so here's the experiment that was done, right? They took mice, or they took people who were clinically depressed. They were diagnosed as depressed. And there's also certain biomarkers that you can measure in blood that will be higher in people that are depressed. And they took their microbiome and they put it into a mouse that had never had any microbiome at all. So it gets the human microbiome and it establishes it. And they turned out the mice became anxious and depressed. And you may be wondering, well, how do you measure whether a mouse is anxious? You can't ask it. And they actually have come up with some really clever experiments. So one thing you'll do, you put them in a box that they've never been in. And if they're more anxious, they will stay near the walls of the box. Whereas if they're not anxious, they'll go, you know, all over the box. And people will go, oh, wait a minute, come on. Well, you can measure those same biomarkers in a mouse. And you will see that, yes, they're raised in the mice that stay near the corners. And they're not raised in the mice that go through the thing. And then for depression, there's some what I think are kind of pretty mean tests. One of them is called a forced swim test, where they basically put a mouse in a beaker and see how long it will try to get out when it can't and before it gives up. And they take it out before, you know, it drowns. Yeah. But they time how long that is, and depressed mice will give up sooner. So they can measure it. But the really important take-home message from that test is that, yeah, anxiety and depression have a microbiome component to it. Now, the real question is there something else that's influencing their microbiome to make them depressed? Or is the microbiome and what's in it contributing to their depression? Obviously, it's not the only thing. But these experiments kind of suggest the microbiome definitely affects it.
God, really fascinating research. Carolyn called, couldn't stay with us when you're washing your hands. Back to that. Is it the soap that kills the bacteria or is it the hot water? Did we talk about that?
No, we didn't. It's the soap. All right. Soap has almost all soap has something called SDS in it. It's a detergent. The detergents disrupt the membranes. So the soap will also disrupt the membranes, but it also, you know, just pries them off your hands. And so it's the mechanical water, yes, washing on your hands, but it's also the soap prying them off.
Jeff and Barry Mills wonders, do bacteria have anything to do with fecal transplants?
Actually, bacteria are used for fecal transplants. And so my former coworker, Robin Kurtz, her husband, Mike Sadowski, actually worked on this. And there's a whole bunch of other people that worked with this. And so fecal microbiome transplants can be used to treat C. diff infections. So C. diff infections can be common in hospital patients, especially if they've been treated with antibiotics. And then this organism will take over, and you can actually give them this transplant, and in 95% of cases, it will fix it. It's becoming more and more common for them to do this treatment.
Really cool. Any other, there's so many different pieces of research that have been going on relating to all of this. I mean, there's a couple of bacterial groups that improve motivation.
Yes, yes. And so what they did is they did an experiment where they took students and they looked at it, people were motivated or not motivated, and they actually figured out there were two organisms that the students made them more motivated to exercise. All right? And so what they did is they took those organisms and they gave them to people. And I think it's Coprococcus is one of them, and I'm not remembering the other one. But they gave those to people, and they found that their motivation for exercise increased. So there isn't any more to that, but it's like, what's going on here? And these were double-blind experiments where the researcher and the people taking the drugs giving these organisms didn't know if it was the real organism or not. And so they really seem to be legitimate. So that's fascinating stuff that's going on.
And your microbiome, another part of research related to heart disease.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So some of this is that they have found certain organisms that will be in the arterial plaque of organisms, and that how did those guys get there? Okay, that's one question. The other thing is they've done some studies with fiber and heart disease,
mm-hmm.
which are quite interesting. And what they found is that it really depends on, they'll tell you to eat fiber and it's good for you,
yeah.
et cetera. And it is for a lot of other reasons, but there's information that shows it helps in cardiovascular disease. But the research showed that it was really inconsistent, that it worked for some people and didn't for others. So Federico Rey, again, another professor in our department, was interested in this. And what he did is he took microbiomes from three different donors, right? One of them where the cardiovascular effect was real, who ate fiber, and two where it wasn't. And what he did is he then gave that again to mice that didn't have anything. And then they fed them a terrible diet, the equivalent of Big Macs and fries and shakes and stuff. So a terrible Western diet. And saw what happened, but then he gave them fiber, right? And again, it wasn't terrible. It was standard chow, but it was not the best. And what he found is only in donor A do you see this improve. They then, euthanized the mice, looked at their arteries, et cetera, and you saw a marked difference in the mice that ate fiber, but not in the other ones. And so what it shows you is that the fiber only works if you've got the right microbiome. And so they did more work, and what they found is that the donor A microbiome specifically produced butyrate that from the fiber that then fed the cells in the gut, and that's where the effect came from. And they identified a bunch of organisms that it could be, but I'm not going to name them because I really don't know.
Out of time, too.
Okay, good.
Tim, this has been a great hour, a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. I hope we can do this again.
Yeah, thank you, Larry. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, man. Tim Postgen, a distinguished professor in the Department of Bacteriology at UW-Madison. Turning our attention next to plastics, and we'll talk some more about that right after this look at the news. You stay with us.